And if we could make sure our cell phones are turned off or set to silent, I'd like to introduce our speaker tonight from Santa Monica, Adam T.
My name is Adam. I'm an alcoholic. Want to thank the group. Thank you for inviting me to come talk tonight. It's always an honor and a privilege to be asked to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. Ultimately, it's a responsibility to give back what was so freely given to me. Welcome to, you know, people that are new. You know, if you're trying AA again, if you don't want to be here tonight, if you don't think this will work for you, you know, we always say, sorry it's come to this. I didn't get to AA because I had a bad weekend. You know, I had a couple of bad decades. And for me, like a lot of us, eventually this becomes a matter of life and death. I mean, every meeting has their perpetual newcomer. Especially if you live in a small community like this, you know, you see that lost soul recycling through the rooms. I live in Los Angeles. You know, we all know we have like, it's a metropolis. We have about 3,000 meetings a week in the greater LA area. And I stood up for 17 years as a newcomer. And, you know, I had so many chips and key tags, right? We know the drill. I could have played poker with them, you know. I remember one secretary saying, give them back. You know, and if you're new, I did that walk of shame over and over and over, and I know what that feels like. And it's horrible, and I thank God for the unconditional love of the old-timers. A lot of the old-timers in our area that aren't with us anymore, a lot of those old guys that died with 30, 40 years sober, and they'd watch me come in and out of the rooms, and they would say things to me like, don't even bother taking chips, just sit in the back, shut up. No, but in a loving way, right? You know. But they made it really clear to me, and if you're new, I hope you hear this. They made it really clear to me that if and when I was ready, because somehow they could see it. They could see it by my demeanor, my lack of interest, my fidgety nature. Somehow those old guys had the wisdom to see, just maybe by my attitude, I don't know about age, but they had the wisdom to see that maybe it wasn't right now. But they were so kind to me. They made it really clear to me that if and when I was ready, that the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous would always be open to a drunk like me. And I think looking back at that experience now, next to my parents, if you're new, AA is probably the closest thing to unconditional love that a drunk like me will ever experience. No matter how many lives I destroyed, how many people I burned, how many jobs I lost, how many cars I wrecked, how many hearts I broke, how many despicable, shameful things I did. And if you are, in fact, an alcoholic, it's the most shameful thing in the world to be the family drunk. Especially if you come from a large family like I do. My mom had three sisters and a brother. My dad, three brothers and a sister. And, you know, she told him everything. You know, it's humiliating. I mean, there's still large groups of my family that will never, ever talk to me again in this lifetime. And I'm 25 years sober. If you think all your amends are going to go seamlessly, they didn't go seamlessly. You know, and I know my mom and dad loved me. I was an only child. I was atop of all my classes. They had so much expectation and hope for me. My parents were married almost 50 years. And you see the love. I mean, even here, you probably see the love outside these elementary schools, right? In LA, we get lines. I mean, they block whole streets to pick up their kids. It's awful. You want to shoot them, right? But, you know, to watch my mother and father, to watch those two people literally watch me burn my life to the ground. To the point where eventually my mom, it's funny, she had sold the family property, she moved, and she didn't leave a forwarding address. That's where I left her when I was in an institution. So I come out to this empty home, and despite all of that, that high price we pay for this almost despicable low quality of life, right? This systemic family disease called alcoholism, which I couldn't see through the lens of Al-Anon. I couldn't see the destruction, the annihilation of everything worthwhile that Wilson talks about until much later. But despite all of that, if you're new, the doors of AA have always been open to people like me. If I lived to be 100 years old, I could never pay AA back for the love and kindness that, you know what, some of you people have shown me. Not all. I mean, if you think all is utopia, if you like everybody in AA, you know what it means? It means you're not going to enough meetings. My sponsor said, Adam, you don't have to like anyone in particular, but if you stick around AA, if you go through the 12 traditions, you'll learn to love people in Alcoholics Anonymous you may not even like. And what happened to me eventually, and I hate to say this, but eventually I started coming to meetings drunk. Now, the interesting thing about AA 2024, if you actually see a drunk person in a nice meeting like this these days, people say things like, oh my gosh, what's he doing here? I mean, ironic as it may be, right? We don't see a lot of wet alcoholics in AA anymore. And I don't want to bash the therapeutic community. I saw the druggy buggy out there. But you know, I mean, for me, treatment would swoop me up in my most desperate moments, right? Throw me into yoga class. I mean, somehow that's their answer, right? Craft hour. I mean, I can't believe they're surprised when I'm making belt buckles and bongs, right? Hello? Nature walks. I mean, shocking, right? I'm walking to 7-Eleven, getting a big gulp cup, filling it up with liquor, putting a little Coca-Cola on top, walking into the late night Hollywood candlelight meeting, doing some of my best sharing. You know, and then I started going through institutions. And it's interesting, if you're new, we have a chapter in the big book, the chapter to wives, right? If you haven't read the chapter to wives, it's in the back. I never read the chapter to wives. I never had a wife. None of my very own, right? I just want to stir it up a little bit. But if you read the chapter to wives, it's very explicit. It talks about four types. Type 1, type 2, type 3. And the fourth type, which is really the progression. Magic, medicine, misery. Fun with problems, just problems. The fourth type of alcoholic described in the chapter to wives is a type of alcoholic that's been placed in one institution after another. Sound familiar? The type of alcoholic that typically drinks on his way home from the hospital. And in the 17 years that I recycled through Alcoholics Anonymous, albeit in one of the largest groups of AA in the world, with all this information and all this fellowship, I still became that fourth type. By the time I finally got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd gone through residential treatment for alcoholism 28 times. Right, not 28 days like the movie. This isn't Hollywood, right? 28 times. And I'm wearing that like some kind of ridiculous badge of honor. I'm thinking, that's what makes me an alcoholic. And I remember telling my late sponsor I'd gone through treatment 28 times. I was hoping that would, like, get rid of the guy, you know, loser. Go find someone that's willing. I was like, you know, one of those overzealous guys that chases you around. I didn't want to ruin his batting average. So I tell him I went through treatment 28 times. And he starts laughing hysterically. And I'm like, I don't think that's funny. And he says, going through treatment 28 times, that doesn't make you an alcoholic. And I thought, you're kidding. He says, oh, no, that just means you paid $500,000 for a big book. And I didn't think that was funny. And I'm not going to start citing and quoting pages tonight out of the big book. But page 101 of the big book says, any scheme that attempts to shield the alcoholic from temptation is doomed to failure. See, treatment was a great place to fatten me up for another run. Treatment has its rightful place in recovery. Even Bill Wilson had gone through treatment, right? If you ever wonder what all the treatment centers and religions have in common, it's obvious. They all send their drunks to us. Some people don't go through treatment. It's not a prerequisite. Dr. Silkworth says we favor hospitalization or treatment for the alcoholic that's befogged or jittery. But for me, like a lot of us, my experience was is that treatment never solved the problem. And as an alcoholic, like a lot of us, I always thought the problem was liquor. I thought it was alcohol. And I remember someone in AA saying to me, Adam, if alcohol's your problem, that drink, that shot glass, that 12-pack, that little glass of Chardonnay, if that's your problem, you're probably not an alcoholic. And then he paused, and in the very next breath, he says to me, and if you are in fact an alcoholic, the type that's described in the doctor's opinion, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, your problem is an alcoholic. And I'm like, what? It took another decade for me to understand what he was trying to tell me. It was almost like some kind of cruel riddle. I drank over that for years. But what happened to me, because we use the word in AA often, serendipity, what happened to me Because we talk about what happened a lot. What happened is I got around a group of big book enthusiasts. People in Alcoholics Anonymous that took the statements in the big book, turned them into questions, directed the questions at me. Very simple ideas. Like, was I incapable of being honest with myself? Did I in fact drink because I liked the effect produced by alcohol? Duh, that's a no-brainer, right? How about this? Was I restless, irritable, and discontent by nature? Was that my natural state before my lips ever touched alcohol? Was my greatest obsession that somehow, someday, I would control and enjoy my drinking at the same time? And the last piece, did I pursue that illusion, meaning just out of reach to the gates of insanity or death? And as I went through those considerations, if you're like me, what happened is for the first time I saw the truth. And the most obvious truth, what we call the external unmanageability, was crystal clear to me. Even from the time I was in eighth grade, from the first time I drank, I was already peeing in my pants. I was already drooling on my desk. I was already passed out under the bleachers. I overshot the mark from the very first time I drank. That's my story. My nickname in eighth grade was Space Cadet. I couldn't find homeroom. People were picking high schools. I was already picking rehabs. But if you're new tonight, alcoholism comes in people. It doesn't come in bottles or six packs or 12 packs or kegs or shot glasses or little glasses of wine. Alcoholism comes in people. And the greater aspect of this spiritual illness, as Bill Wilson describes it, centering in my mind, if going through the considerations in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous shows me anything at all, it shows me that an alcoholic of my type, an alcoholic of this type, cannot really live without alcohol, not successfully, not happily. And part of what it really means for me to be an alcoholic, if I'm honest about my relationship with liquor, if I really look at my history, is that I seem to have a mind that will consistently take me back to that first drink. Every time I get released from a treatment center, an emergency room, a hospital, right? Men's Central Jail, 5743, roll it up. It's amazing to me. I'm sitting in county jail, in my cell, casually reading a novel, not a cloud on the horizon. And I hear that number, 5743, roll it up. And suddenly I have this visceral compulsion to drink that is so powerful in me that I can't even stop at the release module for my property. As soon as I've made that transition, that decision to drink, there is nothing on God's earth that's going to stop me. That has been my experience. And what's so funny about that is I come to an AA meeting and you well-meaning people say things to me like, well, don't drink no matter what. And I'm like, because I'm literate, right? I read the book, taking it apart. It says on the top of page 24, every alcoholic passes through the state where even the strongest desire, it says, is of absolutely no avail. It says my willpower will become virtually non-existent. So I know people mean well when they say things like that. And for many people, that might be true. But to have lost the power of choice. And when I hear people say don't drink no matter what, there's a translation for some of us. And what it is go to meetings no matter what, work steps no matter what, maintain commitments no matter what, be of service no matter what, develop this discipline of steps 10, 11, and 12, which is peace, power, and purpose, respectively. And suddenly, like the doctor's opinion says, this person that seemed absolutely doomed is easily able to control his desire for alcohol. What a powerful thing that is. You know, and without promoting AA too much, it's interesting because people often, and you hear it a lot in the therapeutic community, AA has no evidence-based results. I'm like, really? Go to a world convention like the one coming up in Vancouver next year. Check out 85,000 alcoholics converging on a random city every 5 years. And you can't do that with your insurance. They don't pay for that. You have to get a plane ticket, conference ticket, hotel room, probably a rent-a-car. Right? But what's so fascinating about that is for all those people that have made that, and here's the word if you're new, effort, that have made that kind of effort. When they do the out-of-towners at a world convention, it's like the United Nations. It takes 2.5 hours just for the newcomers, you know, the people from out of town to identify. It's amazing. And for every one of those people, there's a son, a mom, a daughter, a sister. There's a world of people that will tell you that AA is the most powerful thing in their loved one's life. So what it seems to me, when I really look at that evidence, and you know, we talk about the Big Book, but a lot of people don't realize the Big Book, if you look it up, the top 88 books in the United States Library of Congress that shaped America, it's still in that list. It's affected the lives of, like, what we say now, 30 to 40 million people worldwide. And you know why I don't think it's going to work for me? Because it wasn't my idea. But even Harvard and Stanford have done studies on the 12-step programs and said the effectiveness of these 12-step programs exceed all the others combined. My sponsor said, it doesn't matter who's wrong. It doesn't matter who's right. It just matters who's left. And when I look at the birthdays tonight and I see people come up here with 10, 20, 30 years, if you're new, that's the evidence. People that are chasing their dreams, that have relationships that work, that have learned how to navigate around the drama, that have learned how to match calamity with serenity, people that have learned how to stay in fit spiritual condition. What happened to me, and people ask me, is I became teachable. If you're new, at some point in my recovery, I became willing to take actions in Alcoholics Anonymous that I did not yet believe in. So what it really means for someone like me to be an alcoholic, and I had to be very, very clear on this. My friend of mine says, Adam, it's like a cliff at your heels. Wherever you go, alcoholism will follow you. But if you work these steps, you live in 10, 11, and 12, you can stay way ahead of that cliff. But if I don't, it'll nip at my heels. What it really means to be an alcoholic is I have this mind that will continue to take me back to booze. It's almost like my default program. And it's funny, I sponsor a lot of really smart guys. Where I live now is called Silicon Beach. And the reason they call it that, no, because we've got Snapchat, Yahoo, Google, get all these really amazing tech companies. And a lot of the guys that work for those companies come to our meetings, you know, the new guys. And these are engineers, people that program, they design hardware, software, they speak in languages like Python and Java. But if you're new, here's a mathematical equation. Potential plus alcoholism equals zero. Very interesting. Just so you know. So I had the privilege of sponsoring a lot of really smart guys. People that are far my intellectual superior. But we've had that, you know, we talk about the language that Bill Wilson uses in 1939 when this book was published and how really advanced it was for that time period. Because as a lot of us know, one of the definitions of the word program, what it is a sequential set of instructions just read tonight, right? Designed to do what? A purpose. Designed to bring about a result. Now think about it. What do you do when you get a corrupt file on the computer? It's obvious. Listen to the language. You employ a recovery disk. That's what you install. And the function of that disk is to restore that program, just like the second step, to its original condition, the original self, the self that's not driven by fear, by selfishness, by resentment. See, it never occurred to me that 10 and 11 in many ways really becomes like a viral scan. That if I follow these real simple instructions, and I know this sounds technical, but if I follow these very simple instructions, what happens when I get to 10 is I become mindful. I become accountable. I become transparent. I'm able to see where I paint the red flags green on a consistent basis. I'm able to navigate around the drama. I develop what's called spiritual fitness. Those 10-step promises are amazing. We talk about the 9-step promises, but when it talks about the problem has been removed, we cease fighting anybody or anything. We recoil as if from a hot flame. These are powerful. For someone that couldn't go 5 minutes, 5 minutes was eternity. It never occurred to me that really, in reality, when Bill Wilson talks about principles before personalities, in many ways, it was the founder's future hope that these spiritual instructions, these guidelines, would have more impact. And I hate to say the opinions in the rooms, because I love the fellowship. I love coming. You guys were so kind, so hospitable to me. You guys fed me. But see, I mean, my mom would have parties with 300 people. I had the Dalai Lama at the house when I was a kid. I mean, I was just around that kind of, you know, group of people. See, the fellowship for me gives me enthusiasm. It will give me inspiration. It'll give me encouragement. It'll give me hope, brotherly love. Some people actually find relationships and employment here. But if you release a character like me into a large group of people like this without guiding principles, you know what happens? My character defects thrive. I can actually get sicker in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous without even knowing it. And what that looks like if you're new is somehow consciously or subconsciously, I become more separate, more different, and more alone. And if you haven't heard that terminology, what that actually means is separated from God, different than every single person here. We know that's called terminal uniqueness. We've heard that, right? And alone. You know that loneliness, that ache at the heart of every one of us that really has nothing to do with the proximity or closeness of other people? That loneliness, it might... in the core of my soul, even at my own birthday, my own wedding. In fact, the bigger the crowd, the more alone I am. The loneliness that I know I'm going to feel when I walk out of here alone and I get back in that car that I can't talk about. And if you have that like I do, what that is my inability to connect. And you put a couple of drinks in me, I'm calling people from fifth grade saying, I love you. Hell, I go right into amends. Get me loaded, put a couple of drinks in me, and I'm at one with the universe. I'm standing on the roof of my building howling at the moon. I can touch the stars. A couple more drinks, I'm okay with me. Get me good and drunk, I lose interest in selfish things and suddenly gain interest in my fellows. I'm drunk, right? I'm drunk dialing at 3 a.m. If you're like me, see, alcohol produces the illusion that my life is manageable. It does so much for me, I don't care what it's doing to me. And that's what the Al-Anons and the Earth people can't understand about us. They can't figure out why we get loaded. We can't figure out why you don't. And it doesn't do that for everybody. That effect produced by alcohol, alcohol's classified by the AMA as a depressant. 9 out of 10 people, they have an effect. They have a couple drinks and they're like, whoa, I get it, slow down. I'm feeling it. I have a couple drinks, and honey, I want to get married. I want to go to Vegas tonight. I'm trying to find the car keys I hid for myself before the first drink, right? See, for me, alcohol is a stimulant. And unless I can develop that sense of comfort and ease that I am seeking from alcohol through this spiritual process, which is absolutely possible through these ideas, these steps, these different things that we do here. These specific actions, contribute, belong, and learn. If you take booze away from a drunk like me and you don't give me something better, someone like me will never stay here. And I had to understand that. You take alcohol away from me, and that's everything that this program gave to me. I never understood that, but it was me taking actions I did not yet believe in. So what it really meant for me to be an alcoholic is that I have this mind that will continue if I don't take these other actions to take me back to that drink. It's like my default program. And right next to being separate, different, and alone, if you're new, for me, there's 3 pillars of recovery. The first is to be protected by some kind of God. The second, to be accepted by self. And the third, to be connected to a community. It's interesting. We read a vision for you in a lot of our meetings and you hear it. Right? Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. That's 1 through 3. Admit your faults to Him and your fellows. 4 through 7. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Surrender, catharsis, restitution. That first piece. If you go to the ocean, go to one of these lakes with a cup, you get a cup full of water. What if I go to the ocean with my whole life? Very, very different. And you hear it. You abandon the ship. I can't climb back on. See, I'd never made that commitment. And someone said to me, when we read chapter 5, you hear it. We ask for His care and protection with what? Complete abandon. That's the first piece. The second piece is to be accepted by self. For me, in 4 through 7, what that meant is I no longer needed internal or external validation. Through that process, I develop what's called an internal locus of control. It's a clinical term. You can look it up on your phone. And the third, to be connected to a community. Imagine, protected by God, to feel like that, accepted by self, and connected to a community. And I go from being the weakest link in my family. I'm talking about generations. Every one of us has generations of it. Suicide, mental illness, and alcoholism. And to be 25 years away from that and now be the strongest link in that family to heal in that way, it's impossible. It is said that alcoholism is the only disease, when treated, that will actually leave the sufferer in a better position than if they never had the disease. I'd have never believed it until I got around people in AA who were unique in the fact that they were doing these steps. They were taking the book and they were doing what the book said. And I remember my sponsor looked at me and he said, Adam, how free do you want to be? You want to be just free enough to survive this? In that gray twilight, so when people say, how you doing? You can say, I'm hanging in there. He goes, I'll buy you a drink just to put you out of your misery. He was so mean to me. Or he said to me again, do you want to be free enough to chase your dreams? To have relationships that work? To learn how to navigate around the drama? To be able to develop a spiritual fitness? And I became attracted to that. I became attracted to that idea. And through that, what happened is somehow, for me, the lens through which I saw the life began to change. Just like when Chuck C. talks about a new pair of glasses, I started to see it differently. And one of the biggest differences for me, and I know what it is now, when it talks about the Florida businessman laying in the sunshine, complaining about the state of the nation, we've all heard that. You know, the minister sighing about the sins of the 20th century. We've all heard that one, the safecracker. But what was pointed out to me in that part of the book is that all of those characters have one very thing in common. The difference is one's the finger pointer, one's holier than thou, one plays the victim, but they all have one thing in common. And what it is if people have to change for me to be happy, I'll never be happy. And what Alcoholics Anonymous taught me to do, without a doubt, was to be happy in a dysfunctional relationship, to learn how to be happy in a dysfunctional family, to learn how to be happy in a dysfunctional nation, to be able to be in a position of neutrality like they talk about in that those 10-step promises. What a powerful thing that is. It's almost like if you pet a lion, the lion's got a thorn in its side, of course it's gonna bite me. Every human being has a hidden thorn. I never understood that. Is it my job to point it out or pull it out? Maybe not. So I started to see this very, very simple idea in my life that what it really meant to be an alcoholic is I had to see that my mind would continue to take me back. And in very simple terms, a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and this isn't about other people, it's about my experience, but working with people over the years, a lot of people in AA, just like in the doctor's opinion, it says there's people in AA that are normal in every respect except the effect produced by alcohol. They're normal, able, friendly people. A lot of the guys I drank with, as soon as they stopped drinking, it's amazing. As soon as they stop drinking, everything works for them. They fit in, they're part of, the career welcomes them back. They come up here every year, take another cake, never work a step. Their life gets better. They've been serene since their ass hit the seat in AA. It's not my experience. My experience, every time I stop drinking, the first thing they say to me is, you know, you really need to be on medication. Why are you so angry? Why are you so emotional? What's wrong with you? Why can't you sit still back there? And I'm crying at dog food commercials. When I'm not drinking, I have a whole nother set of problems, and we all know where they are. On page 52, it talks about the bedevilments. When I'm not drinking, if you do, you might want to ask these questions to yourself. When I'm not drinking, am I still a prey to misery and depression? It's a yes or no question. When I'm not drinking, am I still having trouble controlling my emotions? When I'm not drinking, am I still having difficulty with my personal relationships? Hello? When I'm not drinking, am I still full of fear? When I'm not drinking, am I basically unhappy? And the way that plays out for someone like me in what we call untreated alcoholism is I don't fit in, I'm not part of, you don't understand me, everybody's in my way, life's not treating me right, they're not paying me enough, for goodness sake, I gotta drink. And something magic happens. As soon as I pick up a cocktail, I intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle me. Right? Couple more drinks, fear of people and economic insecurity leave me. I'm buying the whole bar drinks. Hell, I'll write you a check. Not only are you getting better looking, honey, I'm getting better looking. Right? Give me a couple Vicodin, I could comprehend the word serenity and I know peace. Little cocaine, I want to start a business with you. You're laughing, there's something really wrong with you. That don't happen in normal people. And my experience, again, is unless I can develop that sense of comfort and ease that I sought from alcohol through this spiritual process, a drunk like me will never stay here. No, I'm not normal in every respect. I am that restless, irritable, discontent type. It never occurred to me when Silkworth talks about that, that it's mind, body, and spirit. It's irritability of the mind, restlessness of the body, discontentment of the spirit. If you look at 10, 11, and 12, 10 is peace, 11 is power, 12 is purpose. The interface is exact. I think we have a new word for restless, right? What is it? Oh, ADD. I don't got ADD. I mean, please, if I found out you had a couple $1 million in the trunk of your car tonight, cash, I'd follow you home from the meeting. I have what's called selective interest disorder. Oh, come on. Anybody ever call the connection and forget you called them? No. I see a woman or a motorcycle or a truck or something I want, I have laser focus. I don't know. It sounds great. It's not true. I have an irritability, which means I'm quick to anger, I'm slow to forgive, right? I keep score in every relationship that I'm in. Sound familiar? Anybody got the fault-finding mind? Come on. I get between me and the coffee pot, it starts. And then on top of that, I got this discontentment of my spirit, which means the shine wears off everything right away. It doesn't matter what I get. I get a brand new car. I've been saving all year for the car. I don't even get it off the dealer's lot. It's the wrong color. Right? Oh, come on. New house? I'm not even out of escrow. Hate the neighbors. Hate them. And the dog. They got that dog. I get a new job. I'm making more money I've ever made in my life. I start doing the math. Getting ripped off. Right? Relationship? Come on. Love of my life. Soulmate. Couple weeks in, I'm correcting her. So there's something else going on. And unless I can see that, unless I can start to understand what that really means, that what really happens to someone like me, and this is, I didn't understand this, that I stopped drinking, and very simple, the outside seemed to get better, right? But the insides get worse. And the longest bridge I'm ever going to cross, the longest journey I will ever walk in recovery, if you're new, is that little dash between the first and second half of step one. It's telling me I got a body that can't process alcohol, but more importantly, I have a mind that can't process reality, not to my liking. So I got a body that can't drink and a mind that has to? You don't think that's a dilemma? Again, that's what normal people don't understand about us. They can't figure out why we drink. We can't figure out why you don't. And for years, I thought, because I drink, therefore my life's unmanageable. And that's like looking at the tip of an iceberg and seeing the ruined marriage, broken home, financial destitution, the failing health, and thinking that's the problem. In fact, again, that's what treatment tells me the problem is. That's why I'm sitting in another fancy Malibu treatment center in my nightgown, learning about my triggers. And I'm like, excuse me, counselor, waking up's a trigger for me. I'm awake. And she's like, sir, will you please go back to your dorm and button up your nightgown? And if you're new, what I discovered for me, like a lot of us, it seems that for someone like me, the trigger is actually on the inside. Anybody ever notice when an alcoholic's not having a good day? You know when I'm not having a good day? When I'm not getting my way. Oh, come on. We're all like five-year-old kids here with old people's faces. Oh, really? You don't believe me? Cross one of us. I'll resent you for decades. And your grandparents. I'm taking my bucket and my pail and I'm never playing in the sandbox again. You ever wonder why we got 3,000 meetings in LA? It's like, because we got a resentment, we took a coffee pot and we split. But instead of drinking, we just started another meeting. Now there's like, you know, and then it's like, my way's better than your way. It's like all of a sudden there's 300 interpretations of this book. Again, who's left? I look back at 17 years of failure, again, in one of the largest groups of AA in the world. And you know what I see? My defiance towards spiritual principles. And what that means, if you're new, is somehow I will argue with anybody about anything at any time. You tell me it's black, I'll tell you it's white. You tell me it's big, I'll tell you it's small. You tell me to go left, I'll go right with an attitude. Oh yeah, and then I'll blame you for eternity. That's why we say denial is an acronym. It stands for don't even notice I am lying. Think about it. You can tell an alcoholic, you can't tell them much. Oh, you don't believe it? Try sponsoring somebody. And what that means, if you're new, is you can lead me into the gates of hell, but you can't push me into heaven. When we talk about attraction rather than promotion in the 11th tradition, what that meant to a drunk like me is eventually I'll come back to AA on my own terms. Not because sober living wants me to, not because my parole officer wants me to, not because DCSF thinks it's a good idea, right? A lot of people get sober for the trust fund where I live. But see, if you're new, hope doesn't matter to a drunk like me until I'm hopeless. You think hope matters to me when I got $1 million left in the bank, brand new truck, little Harley in the driveway, boat down in the marina? You wouldn't catch me dead in an AA meeting. And if you're new, my experience is that God didn't matter to me until my back was against the wall. And what that looked like for me, and it's not gutter bravado, I got shot in a little argument, went right through me. I'm laying on the gurney, right? I got the paramedics over me with the paddles, and guess what? All I know is God. And you've ever had an experience like that, like a really violent death challenging experience? There's only two things men cry for, and this isn't a people thing. Mommy and God. That's all there is. And it's funny because if you're like me and you had your head in the toilet every morning with the dry heaves puking your guts out, come on, who prays more than drunks like us, please? No offense. If you don't relate, you might be in, I'm not going to say the wrong room. But it's so interesting to me. Like Bill Wilson had talked about, and I'm not being divisive, he talked about having this powerful white light experience, right? And on the very next page, he said it was quickly blotted out by worldly clamors, most of which were where? Within himself. And I can remember, I'm sitting in this cardiologist's office in the hospital. I got a tampon right through me because you have to heal from the inside out. And he runs an angiogram, which is a cord. He runs it through my groin and he pumps this dye onto the TV screen. And he's looking at my heart and he says, the bullet missed. I was like drunk in half an hour. As soon as I heard the bullet missed, I went from God, I will do anything you ask, anything you ask. God, I am your humble servant for eternity, to I need to get out of this facility before law enforcement shows up. That quick. That's how quick that happens. So if you're new, and the point of this talk is that there's a huge difference between the act of surrender, if you're new, right? The act of surrender that gets people like us into AA over and over and over and over again, and the state of surrender that's keeping the old timers here. It's a completely different concept. And I never understood it. It's like watching a swan glide across a pond of still water. It's so beautiful. So effortless, right? It's so graceful. But we all know what the bird's doing under the water, right? Paddling like hell. And my sponsor pointed out to me immediately, Adam, there's a chapter in the book, Into Action. He said, there's no chapter into feelings. No offense to the therapists, right? Into thinking. Right? Maybe into whining from the podium at the noon meeting. I'm like, get a job, bro. So, and without bashing again, that community. There's a therapy called cognitive behavioral therapy. We've all heard of it. It's expensive. In AA, by the way, it's a dollar. The economics of AA is amazing. And basically, the fundamental idea is I can't think my way into right living, right? But I can live my way into right thinking. So the challenge for me was based on this premise. If I put a weight pile in the middle of this room and every day for 90 minutes, I lift weights for 90 minutes every day, am I going to get strong? Absolutely. Does it matter how I feel about it? Or what I think? So what my sponsor said was, you take that triangle, recovery, unity, and service, and you translate it into three actions: contribute, belong, and learn. Recovery, unity, and service, right? Service is to contribute. Unity is to belong. Recovery is to uncover, discover, and discard that which is blocking me from God, self, and others. A very, very simple idea. And what he said to me is, the more I contribute, my soul might be blind, but I will feel needed here. The more that I have these commitments, the more I'm involved in this type of service, the more I will be here. The more I show up at meetings, which is unity, like community, the more I will feel like I belong. The more I uncover, discover, and discard that which is blocking me, the more that I can, for the first time in my life, give and receive love. What a powerful thing. It's almost like the steps bring me wisdom, the fellowship where two or more are gathered bring me power, and by reaching back in my community, I have purpose for the first time in my life. I'll simplify it. My head, my heart, and my feet need to be moving in the same direction. And you know what? As soon as I learn that piece, that I could do that, not only here, I could do it at my job, I could do it with my family, everywhere I go, whether I'm doing dishes or helping someone move, I have to be of service. And I never understood that that was the idea. If selfishness and self-centeredness are the root of my problem, the solution has to be service-centeredness. It has to be God-centeredness. It has to be other-centeredness. And by doing that simple thing, I went from living in institutions for 17 years to having a reasonably beautiful life. I was just sharing this with someone in the back. I was driving up here and I was, and it is nice. It's like, this is probably the most pristine time of year in this part of the country. A lot of times it looks like a dust bowl here, right? But it was so beautiful. I almost had a little, it just shook me. When I saw those lakes today and I realized how lucky I am. You know, you get those weird moments where suddenly you realize that all this time has passed. My dad's almost on his deathbed right now. And I told him, I said, it's been such an honor and a privilege to take care of you. You know, I could have never said something like that. You know, what a gift this has been for me. And but in order to keep this gift, I had, like they say, like you, it's like mining gold. You can only keep it by giving it away. It's a weird thing. It's almost like my sponsor said, 10 clears the channel, 11 fills the channel, 12 empties it. That if I can keep this channel clear, then I become a conduit of God's love. Lord, make me a channel of thy peace. This is the system here that we do through these ideas brings about peace, power, and purpose. I never saw that there was so much more here. I thought for years this was the program. But it's one piece of it. It's one leg in a three-legged stool. So thank God we don't look like our stories, right? So what happened to me is I got to one more treatment center, right? I was 120 pounds. This is what I look like. I was dying of alcoholism. I was yellow. You know, I stunk like urine, right? A vision for you. And I'm, you know, in my nightgown, 120 pounds, sitting in the detox, right? With my ass hanging out, judging the speaker. It's so funny how we're the only people that can literally be on the curb and still look down at the world. Right? I got two speeds, grandiose and comatose. And I'm strutting around the detox bragging about Robin Brink's trucks. I finally did my four step. It was a bread truck. It was empty. So I'm sitting there in the detox with my fellow associates, and this woman comes in on what's called an H&I panel. I know a lot of you guys know. H&I stands for hospitals and institutions. It's a committee, as you know. If you don't, I'm saying this for the new people. It's a committee that brings meetings into prisons, treatment centers, detoxes, hospitals, anywhere where clients, patients, or inmates can't get to meetings. I know in a smaller community, it's a little different. In really big communities, it's almost like we need H&I to connect with people because the meetings are so big that they're impersonal. Our H&I, where I live, is about 250 people. They meet once a month, and they're fighting each other to get on panels to talk to people in treatment centers that don't care. But I mean, the cohesiveness of that group. So this woman's on the H&I panel. She's doing her AA talk. At the end of her talk, she looks us all up and down and she says, if I could give you all the gift of recovery, I wouldn't do it. And I looked at her and I remember looking at the guy next to me and I said, what a bitch. Because I thought she was being selfish. And then she said something that would later change my life. If you're new, she said, the reason I wouldn't give you the gift of recovery is because I wouldn't rob you of the journey. And all these years later, if you're new, I've come to understand that that journey to recovery, just like that journey to surrender, right? That each and every alcoholic has to walk is personal. If you're new, we can't give you that. Again, not to be divisive, but if you're in a hot tub with a supermodel, a fifth of whiskey and an eight ball, and daddy sends you to rehab, we don't expect you to be happy. I mean, come on, does anybody ever get interrupted in the middle of like a 12 pack or a fifth of whiskey? It's like, it's awful. That's why we say, oh, my worst day sober is better than my best day drinking. I'm like, are you out of your mind?
Yeah.
But my worst day sober is better than my last day drinking. Right? Some perspective where the disease was killing me every day and it wouldn't bury me kind of drinking. That gift of desperation is an acronym for God, the gift of desperation. But if you're like me, and again, not gutter bravado, but what happened to me, like a lot of us, is I got to a place where my head couldn't get enough and my body couldn't take any more. Anybody seen that kind of drinking? When my head can't get enough, my body can't take any more, and I'm knocking on death's door, right? And people are watching this. God means something totally different to me. It means grow or die. Then I understand that this isn't virtue. We talk about this being virtue. It's grace and it's circumstance. When I get to that place where my head can't get enough and my body can't take any more, I know what it means to drink against my will. When everything in my life demands that I stand and deliver and I can't do it. That's breaking my own heart in a different way. And the book talks about then I have these two alternatives. They're not choices. One is to go on to the bitter end, right? Blotting out the consciousness of my intolerable situation. Skid Row's full of people like that. I'm not any better than the guy at 7-Eleven tonight begging. It could have just as easily been me. And the other alternative is to accept spiritual help. It's very interesting. It's like suddenly my hand's going to be forced. Faced with alcoholic destruction or to live on a spiritual basis, it says these are not easy alternatives. I mean, do a survey at Walmart. You got jails, institutions, and death. Happy, joyous, and free. It's a no-brainer. You step over to my cell in Men's Central Jail, you ask me that question, I'm thinking, how bad an alcoholic though? Can I talk to my counselor, my parole officer, my therapist, my MFT, and get back to you on Monday? And I'll justify, minimize, and rationalize my right to drink. That's why we say God can't use a man or woman till they come to the end of themselves. And all those things really impeded me from that one idea that they say God is, you don't realize he's all you need till he's all you have. And what I discovered for me is, for a lot of us, working with new people, again, just my experience, that the bottom seems to be the same for all of us. From Yale to jail, Park Avenue to Park Bench, what the true bottom for me, the elements of the bottom were for me, was one, when I asked for help. But more importantly, because a lot of people come to AA looking for help. The more important one is when I'm actually willing to receive it. Now, I'll simplify it. I throw you a life raft, and you look at the life raft and you say, you know, I was looking for a blue one. Do you know how hard it is to work with someone? I don't really like the way you threw it, bro. I mean, it's so hard. I mean, it's like, that's the kind of comeback that I had with people. It's so funny, if you're new, we're the only people that want a reward because we ran out of a burning building. I mean, really, you're feeling heroic because you gave up your big Saturday night, right, in Orca to hang out with us? This is the only place on God's earth where they'll applaud because you came in to save your own life. Please. You're wondering when the miracle's going to happen? You're in an AA meeting in the middle of nowhere on a Saturday night. It's happened. I was told my sobriety is God's gift to me. What I do with it is my gift to God. I was told by an old timer many years ago, Adam, there are three prayers in this life. The first one is God, give me, greatest distraction on earth. The second, God, help me. But the most important prayer, and I think this is it, is God, use me. There's not a lot of time. I'll tell you a couple of really quick things. This is where I'm going to brag. If I were to brag about anything, I was at an airport, I was at the gate, I was dressed up nice, I'm waiting for a plane, and this guy comes running up to me. And he's wearing a slingshot t-shirt, full body tattoo, he's got the teardrops, the whole thing, and he rushes me at the gate and he's like, you don't remember me, do you, bro? Real aggressive. I mean, I jump back like 3 feet. I'm like, no, I don't remember you. And I thought he was going to hit me up for money, right? I'm just like this twisted kind of aggression. And I'm looking for security. And there's a moment. And he's got these two little girls with him. He's got this lady by his side. And there's this moment. And then he says to me, 15 years ago, you spoke on a prison panel. And something you said changed my life. These are my beautiful daughters. This is my amazing wife. This is my family. We want to thank you. And all of a sudden, the wife starts crying. Like the faucet comes on. She's crying. Now the kids are crying. Just like kind of this. Now I'm crying, right? A minute ago, I'm like, I didn't know whether to take a swing or run. And now I'm like, because you don't do that at an airport, right? Now we look like the long-lost family from the old country. This is what I can tell you. I remember calling my sponsor. My sponsor's like, Adam, you got a big mouth and a good memory. Don't let it go to your head. Click. Which is true. But if you're new tonight, I will tell you this. There are two dates in a human being's life. The day we're born and the day we find out why. All my life, I thought it was about money, property, and prestige. Job, house, relationship, car. Bigger job, different house, different relationship, different car, bigger house. And I played musical poisons in the first half of step one. Unfortunate for people like us, if you have what I have, puke smells the same in a Mercedes. See, unfortunate for someone like me, for some reason, the path that I chose, I can't solve a spiritual problem with a physical solution. I will die trying. I was bestowed with everything life could offer, and I burned it to the ground like a lot of us. That purpose, the day we're born, the day we find out why, that thing about being here and being uniquely qualified to be able to reach back in a community and help somebody. And most of them don't want it, right? They say they want it, but the life raft idea, the blue life raft, you know, when I got out of that 28 residential treatment center, the guy that was running the detox said to me, Adam, why don't you come back to our lovely hospital next week, tell all the patients here how you managed to stay sober a whole week, if you can make it. And then the guy threw me off the property. I'm like, I was so hurt. We sensitive when we're new. I was so hurt by the way he rejected me that for the next 8.5 years, I sat in 2 hours of bumper-to-bumper traffic from South LA County to the West Valley in LA to tell a bunch of strangers in a detox how I stayed sober another week and I was tricked into service. Oh my God, it never occurred to me. It never occurred to me that the reason I couldn't get sober for all those years was because I misunderstood the exercise. It never occurred to me when Bill Wilson got out of that third treatment center, Towns Hospital, 1935, he said, quote, he was a broken man. He'd lost everything in life worthwhile. He was plagued with waves of depression. And Bill got a very simple idea. Maybe if I go back in the hospital and talk to some of the patients, I'll feel better. That's all it was. I mean, people somehow have translated that into selfishness, but it's not. And he called Dr. Silkworth. Silkworth at that time was a double board certified physician in psychiatry and neurology. He was the lead physician at the most prominent hospital in the Western world. Trust fund babies from all over came to see Silkworth, even from Europe. Now it's the Rehab Riviera out here. But Silkworth says, with all our ultra modern standards, in the doctor's opinion, our scientific approach, we're not well equipped. I wrote in the book, I can't fix you. They couldn't fix people like me. Their best answer, even today, is they're going to give me a pill that's going to take away my cravings. My mom's like, can they give you one that'll stop you riding motorcycles and chasing women too? It's ridiculous. So Silkworth knew that unless people like me had an entire psychic change, there was almost little hope. So he allowed Bill Wilson with this novel idea. He said, Bill, you want to do what? He'd never heard of such a thing. But he allowed Bill Wilson to come into town's hospital. And what he witnessed from 1935 to 1939, Dr. Silkworth, I was just at his grave last week in New Jersey. Dr. Silkworth said, the cases we followed have been most interesting. Many of them are amazing. He was so amazed that if you look at the first endorsement in the doctor's opinion, it says you can absolutely rely on anything these men say about themselves. That was a letter of credibility given to Bill Wilson by a double board certified physician on the town's hospital letterhead with his personal phone number. This guy, a double board certified physician, staked his reputation on Bill. And here's the last piece. What did Bill really know? Bill had this little experience with Abby, surrender, catharsis, restitution, and service. But Bill, we know, was grandiose. He was immature. He was sensitive, right? Like a lot of us. But Bill got something called a servant's heart. There's only two kinds of people on this earth. There's guests and there's hosts. The guest is never happy. No onions on my burger. Wanted a king-size bed. I can't believe what you got me for my birthday, right? I mean, no offense, but like, but the host comes at life very differently. And it never occurred to me that if you look at the third step prayer, the seventh step prayer, they're saying the same thing. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them would bear witness to those I could help. Remove from me the things that are blocking me from being useful. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves, to adjust myself to be of maximum service. Our old friend Clancy said, alcoholics need to feel useful more than they will ever need to be loved. If you're new, we can show you how to be useful. We can show you a way to get free of this. And by doing that simple thing, whatever you're meant to be on this earth, you will find out. Thank you very much.